Russ House, thank you very much for being with us here at the Institute for Medic Studies and our interviews, Conversations from the Edge, what spiritual teachers often say in private. We're glad that you've taken time out of your schedule to be here with us because of your extensive background in alchemy.
Mark, so, I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you.
I was wondering, your name for, we don't want to call it exactly a household name, no pun intended, in alchemy, but maybe you could give our listeners a little bit of background on yourself and what brought you to alchemy.
I grew up in Kentucky during the era of the Sputnik, the space race, and I was, my parents were wonderful, really. They encouraged me to learn to look into pretty much anything I wanted. And I had, I think, library card number 26 for when the local library started issuing cards. So I was continually in libraries and mostly nonfiction things, even at 7 and 8, reading about microscopy and things of this nature. And when I was 9 years old, which would have been around 1961, I already had the second Gilbert chemistry set and set it up in my parents' home and did lots of experiments. And in the early first few pages of the chemistry manual, there was a reproduction of an engraving of an old alchemist in a very messy laboratory. They're always messy, I think. And it just created some question, put some little point in my mind. And I didn't really make much of a connection until years later, still before I was a teenager, I was trying to reconcile spiritual beliefs, religious beliefs, with science. When I would go to my parents' church, I would hear sometimes discussions about agnostics and atheists, and I really didn't quite understand it because I didn't sense that there was some division between the spiritual world and the scientific world. Either things are or they are not. And so I started going into a more extensive library, the State of Kentucky Archives. Were huge. There were hundreds of books on occult subjects. And I started looking for places where science and religion or spirituality interfaced. And I ran into two words consistently. One was alchemy, the other one was Rosicrucian. And I think that my story is not terribly different, except in details, for many people who seek on the path. There are inklings that come at various points in time, and then there are perhaps precipitating moments or where we receive some guidance. So I think my story is not that unique, except in details.
Well, and just as a side note for listeners, the Gilbert chemistry kits at that time and the one that I had about 10 years later were wonderful because you could actually do some serious damage with them without even trying, unlike the later versions, which were made much safer. But I think, as you've said, you're not an alchemist till you've had an explosion in the lab. So I think we started our explosions early. Now, what was your now? Tell us about how you moved into the Rosicrucian Order AM work, and also your relationship through that and with also later Frater Albertus.
Well, something that's in April 25th, 1977, in Louisville, Kentucky, I went with a friend of mine to see Led Zeppelin perform. And I had been growing certain fungus, Psilocybe cubensis, from spores. With an interest in the sciences, it wasn't too hard to come up with methods to do that. And following South American traditions of eating mushrooms in pairs, male and female, I ate 13 pairs. And it did create some amusing incidents during the concert. An excited concert goer sitting next to me would stand up periodically and be excited. And I could no longer get up and couldn't see through them quite yet. So I asked them to sit down. And of course, they were excited. It was a great, great concert. And the third time that I was inclined to ask them to sit down, I said, you know, I'll just relax. I'll stare off into the middle of the Colosseum. I had a vision that I later realized was the Tree of Life. I was in a rectangular coffin, and while I was sitting upright and could feel that orientation, I realized that I was reclining. And I saw the moon in an orbit above me, and then the sun, and the two aligned, and beyond them was a star. I realized that the sun and the moon were my parents, and that it was a moment of birth of a sort. The tie-in to Amwork is that I then saw a portal, two columns with a winged solar disk above on the plinth, and steps going up. And I recognized that this was a school of higher instruction that I was being shown. I went back to the library and tried to discover where the symbolism was used. The library had books that had been donated by Amwork. And while I looked at a number of organizations, I saw that the symbolism was used there. And I think the following year, 1978, I applied for membership and was a Home Sanctum member in Kentucky for nearly 3 years. I then relocated to Chicago, and it's interesting. I was had been hired by a consulting firm, a large one, that the deal was, we pay you. And at a moment's notice, you need to be able to relocate to any city in the U.S. where we tell you you're assigned. So I was some few months of receiving checks, but I couldn't leave the house. We had no cell phones. And you had to be ready to receive a call during business hours. And at some point after going to Rochester, New York for a contract with Xerox and realizing that that was not a good fit, I decided to use some of the principles that I was learning through Amwork, visualization, and I asked that if I was going to be moved to a city, that I could move to one where there was a lodge that was active. And so I ended up in Chicago in 1981. By 1982, I had the alchemical laboratory kit, which I found out that Jean Dubuis had also been introduced to alchemy through the self, through the very same kit. So a different chemistry set.
Well, those home alchemy kits, they began, I believe, sometime in the 1940s and existed as part of the broader spectrum of what AmWork provided to its members through its supply bureau. It created kind of a context of, I don't want to say one-stop shopping, but something close to that, where you didn't go to Amazon. You ordered your membership pins or correspondence tablets, bookmarks, but also these accessories like this their psychic experiment kit or their home alchemy kit. You just ordered it from there, and you know, you waited your 4 to 6 weeks. It showed up on your doorstep, and it was a very different way of learning than what we have today.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it was quite innovative. I would say probably they were the only folks in the Fidosi that could send you a kit to do anything, because as an American order, AmWork really did not have quite the same viewpoint that the European orders, who were by necessity quite secretive for very practical reasons, especially during wartime. But again, here we see Ralph Lewis, whose wife was very much interested in practical alchemy. Ralph Lewis' father had been very interested in practical alchemy. Ralph Lewis was more interested, as I understand it, how are the alchemy kits selling?
Well, and he had a much larger organization to run than his father's. You know, it's quite fascinating that, you know, his father was in charge for 20 years, roughly, 25 years. And then, of course, he's in charge from roughly 1940 until his death. So he grew the organization substantially and had a far different role to play. But within that context, Chicago, where you were at, has a very unique occult history. It's played a pivotal role in New Thought. It had Bode lodges. It had Golden Dawn lodges. Theosophical Society was strong there. And it's always had this powerful nucleus of occult energy running through it. And I remember you saying to me at one time that Nefertiti Lodge was kind of an occult center within the organizational AmWork. And just so listeners know, at one time, these lodges, such as like Nefertiti Lodge or First Pennsylvania Lodge or Johannes Kelpius Lodge, were not known by that name. They would have been actual state grand lodges within that system. So they were at one point very, I don't want to say independent, but semi-independent and responsibly large entities themselves. So they kind of grew their own, I don't want to say their own egregore, but they grew their own personalities or qualities about them. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Nefertiti Lodge in that context.
Nefertiti Lodge was very much, as you said, it was a, while it was part of the lodge system of AmWork, and therefore performed all of the ritualistic roles of a lodge, it had, I believe in the 1920s, it was chapter number 9 of AmWork. And as you said, there was a large number of esoteric occult groups in Chicago. A lot of the very early lodge members were theosophists. Of course, not far from Chicago in Wheaton, Illinois, is the headquarters of the Theosophical Society. And Some of us would make a pilgrimage there and look through their library, which was quite good. Some of the older members, one of my friends, also an alchemist, had been a member of AMWORK since 1937. And I have copies of Isis Unveiled and other Blavatsky works that he read to the point that they disintegrated. And I think that that was an important part of the influences. The same individual had also, during the 1940s, contacted the person who was handling the publications of the Master Amatu. Amatu was, at that time, during the war, enrolled in the U.S. Navy, or enlisted in the Navy, I think as a dentist, if I recall. And my friend contacted, in an attempt to contact him in California, found the person who had been entrusted with all of his papers and received those papers. So after his death, I discovered that my friend had maintained a group with only about four members where they would study Amatu's writings. There were, as I began to travel some and became familiar with other lodges in San Diego, in San Jose, I realized that Nefertiti Lodge was a very strong ritualistic lodge. When for example, the lodges would have a ritualistic team that was appointed by the lodge master. I was on a number of those teams. I served as lodge master later on. We would have training courses. We would study ritual, not just practice it, not just learn the words and the movements, but we studied the layout, the movements in relation to the layout of the temple. There were some very scholarly people who had received deep training in ritual. And so we used them as resources. I remember one time that a visiting Grand Master was a speaker when I was the lodge master and conducting the ritual. And at the conclusion of the ritual, as the officers exit and you might say go into the private place before we go back among the membership, we always felt that when you put on the robe, that you are taking off your outer personality, that you are, you might say, filling an egregoric or an archetypal role. And so I was a bit surprised when the members who had left the ritual before that were standing in silence. And the Grand Master of the Order comes in and is taking off their robe and making, you know, comments that are more suitable for after we dismissed. And I did ask them to stop and stand in silence. Some of the differences, just because of the size of the lodge in San Jose, where you're quite distant from the membership, maybe it takes forever to get there. But I did notice that our actions during lodge rites were absolutely non-frivolous. It was, we weren't there. We were fulfilling roles.
So this was sort of, and I think we discussed this at one point, a variation of that notion of assumption of the God form, or assumption of any kind, where you focus on the qualities that you are to embody for that moment, whether it's in your day-to-day life as a gardener or as a salesperson or as a doctor, or the qualities that you embody for that moment as a person fulfilling a role in a ritual team. So that role is not just something that you are playing at or pretending at, but is a true vehicle on some level for the expression of that intelligence and energy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now let me, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to, for some of the listeners, the fellow that you were talking about, was that George Fenske?
It was.
He's a bit of a character. He was a Grand Lodge officer, of course. His photograph was on an issue of the Rosicrucian Forum, which surprisingly, two issues came into my possession. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about him.
I can. When I started going to the lodge, we had perhaps every month a speaker's day where we would invite someone who had been long in the order, perhaps from outside of our region, perhaps from within it. And they would come and give some lectures and workshops, and they would conduct the ritual convocation. And we would have meals, perhaps a dinner or a luncheon that the members had prepared. And we were fortunate that we had quite a large facility and we could have perhaps 100 people easily in our convocation. One of the people who did not come very often, but was very much sought after, was George Fenske. George was not tall. I'm 5'8". He was perhaps 5'3". A nice-looking fellow, always a gentleman. He spoke with a bit of an accent that betrayed his German origin. He was born near what is now called Danzig. Danzig has a long Rosicrucian heritage. He had joined AMRC in 1937. He had left Germany for the United States, as many people did who could sense that there were some political changes that they did not desire to be part of. And George was an entrepreneur. He, at one time, after I got to know him a bit, AMRC had a Rosicrucians and the Financial something or the other series where they would send someone and talk about investments and legacies and things. And certainly, it's not inappropriate to teach people about finances who may not have much exposure. It can help reduce the stresses of life. So I was with George and the person from the Grand Lodge who was speaking on this. We ate at a restaurant at something of a large table, perhaps a dozen of us. And I remember the man asking George, well, you know, at your age, you're probably looking for some sound investments or some ideas how to make some ongoing income. And he goes, no, actually, at my age, I'm looking for what to do with my money. And he then picked up the tab for the dozen of us in a pretty nice restaurant. George was very unassuming, very quiet, really. And he had founded a company that is now called, I can't remember the name. They came up with stacking toolboxes. They He was a very wealthy man. He left half his estate to Amwerk. And the other half, he said, he would give to a nephew who he thought who would return the money back into the economy in virtually no time. But George was a wealthy man, and I didn't really know that until I got to know him a bit. He was very secretive about his interest in alchemy. And one of the reasons was that Frater Albertus, we might speak about him later, who had been friends, he and George had been friends since the 1940s. And at some point, for example, the lodge in Kansas City, Missouri, everybody there became very much excited about Frater Albertus stuff to the point that it hurt lodge attendance and lodge activities. One of the Grand Masters came out and put, I think it was Rodman Clayson, put Paracelsus College on their hit list of no-no organizations. That if you were, I was lodge secretary once, and they show me this little thin 2 pages in the back of the filing cabinet and say, when you review people for lodge membership, make sure they're not in one of these groups. Well, when George Finsky was, as I understand it, he could walk in and see Ralph Lewis without an appointment. They were very close. And he basically told Ralph Lewis, well, he can't be associated with Paracelsus College, then I resign as the Grand Counselor of the Midwest region. I'm gone. Goodbye. And Jack Glass was a lodge master and resigned as well. Ralph Lewis wrote back to them and said, you know, Clayson's not going to be in here very much longer. Just hold on. We'll fix this.
That's funny in its own way. You know, occasionally we hear these stories from folks about the organizations that were one did not Amwerk didn't want you to be a part of if you were going to be either in Amwerk or in a lodge, and of course some of them were understandable. You know, others, however. I get glimpses and bits of information about, and there's your example there of Paracelsus College. There's a joke going around. I think it was Wyszewski told me about when Israel Regardi applied for membership in Amwerk, it was rejected the first time. Then he applied again under a different name.
Yes. How about that? I like, Joe Lichevsky's book, I quite marvelous, really. And yes, it indicates this, we're here to help mankind, but not you.
Well, you knew Regardi, correct? I mean, through Paracelsus College, didn't you meet him?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that, please?
Didn't you meet Regardi through Paracelsus College?
Finsky and Regardi were roommates.
Oh, okay.
At Paracelsus College, yes. And they got along quite well, absolutely. George said, you know, I like this book and this book of yours, but, you know, some of the others, Regardi said, well, yeah, you know, but I'm a writer, so they can't all be gems.
Yes. That's true. Now, if I understand correctly, when Fenske died, I believe that you and Sue had a particularly interesting experience around that. Is that correct?
Yes. It was, I'm trying to think. Yes, it was in April 1990. I was working in Chicago, and I received a call from a dear mutual friend. And she said, "Are you sitting down?" And I wasn't. My knees were wobbling, and I sat. And she said, "George is gone." And it was devastating news to me. He had become a dear friend. And among the things that he was passionate about and introduced me to was aromatherapy. For example, we would use pure essential oil of rose and the absolute of jasmine, for example. There were times we used those in meditations, and Scriabin's poem of ecstasy, for example, with some of the music that we used. And it's nothing like smelling a genuine oil of rose. And he would put a drop on my third eye for the meditation. So when I received the news that he had passed, I left and went to the train station to take the train home. And while I was there, it occurred to me, I said, I called my wife. I said, "Sue, when was it that the clock stopped? When was that?" And it had been 3 days before, as I recall. What had happened, I've always had a difficult time waking up and had jobs where I had to be up early. So I had a plug-in electric clock radio, a wind-up clock in case the power went off, and some other third alarm clock in my bedroom. One morning I wake up and all three clocks had stopped at the same time. All three. And so something running on batteries, something plugged in a wall, bam, they're all done. A few days later, they had arranged for his memorial service. And so Sue and I drove to see his house, which was on the way to the funeral home. And I just wanted to see it again, to have a fond memory of that, thinking I'll never go back there again. And as we neared his house, I asked my wife, "Do you smell that?" She says, "Yes." We smelled rose, unmistakable, pure rose fragrance. And then as we left his neighborhood and went back to take an entrance ramp onto the highway to the funeral home, we both smelled it again. So, yes, it was a nice way of bidding each other farewell and hello.
That's a spectacular story. And just for some listeners who may not know, the rose oil has a particularly unique qualities. And of course, you were mixing it with jasmine, and Amwork had a particular combination of rose oil and eucalyptus that it reserved for its hierarchy period, and I have in my possession behind me in a drawer from my great uncle, rose oil and eucalyptus from the 1930s. And it's, yes. You know, you small doses, keep that around. It's 100 years old when you think about it. It's quite potent combination. Now, could you tell
us
a little
bit? Reminder.
Yes. Well, that is why we're doing these interviews, because there's a lot of wonderful things that many of us have experienced and acquired over the decades. And we're putting it on the record. Could you tell us a little bit about Frater Albertus and how you got involved with him?
Yes. I had, by 1982, I had the alchemical laboratory kit and had set it up and was doing some stovetop distillation of herbal matters. And later that same year, I went back to Kentucky to visit family and happened to think to visit a library at Kentucky State University. I had attended school there, but had never set foot in the library before, and didn't have much time between engagements, but decided to go in. And of course, I know where the 133 numbers are, and you know, I knew the Dewey Decimal System. That was the most valuable thing that I learned in grade school, of course, was how do you use a card index? How do you seek knowledge? How do you become self-directed in your interests? But so I went into the library, looked through the section for Rosicrucian things, alchemical things, and saw a book I'd never seen before. It was titled Praxis Thagirica Philosophica. And it had been published in 1966, limited to 500 copies. It was a translation. The original German from the manuscript dating about 1711 on one page, and on the facing page, an English translation. And in looking through it, the formula and the process didn't interest me particularly. But what I noticed is that there were footnotes, and interesting footnotes, and it had to be from someone who had practical experience in alchemy. And I go, this is what I've looked for since preteen. I'd seen all of the books by so-called library alchemists who repeat all of the assumptions made by previous authors and without adding anything new. And so I was like, wow, so somebody who does something with this is contemporary. And I flipped to the back of the book and saw that there was the Paracelsus College, had been founded in 1960 or 62, depending on who tells the story. And that there was an address in Salt Lake City where you could send for more information, which I did very soon after. The person writing the footnotes was Frater Albertus. His name was Albert Richard Rydell. And he too had moved, he had been born near Dresden, on May 5th, 1911. At some point, he too had decided to leave Germany and came to the U.S. and had become a member of AMWORK. The book that's most familiar of his is likely The Alchemist's Handbook. And it indicates something that, as some of the charts and diagrams around the middle of the book indicate, that they're from a manuscript in the 1700s, that had been gifted to AMWORK. And I spent a long time trying to locate that document, wrote to Ralph Lewis, for example, and not with perfect success did I find it, but Albertus definitely used the language and ideas of an AMWORK member in addressing this book on alchemy. So I began to correspond with the school and to make my weekly visits to the rare bookstores and used bookstores. I eventually collected everything that I could find of his in print. And I read these things over and over for a period of years, because it was not for another 2 years that actually I got to meet him.
And what year was that?
When you went to Pierre? It was 1984 in April when I went to Salt Lake City. Fred Albertus died at age 73 in July. So I was so excited to have met a living alchemist who I had pored over every word and idea that I could find of his in print. Spent 2 weeks in the Prima class. The classes were Prima, Secunda, Tertia, Quartia, and so on up to 7 years. And after taking the first class, of course, I had planned out the rest of my next 6 years, how to arrange vacations and things to go to Salt Lake. And yet I received a call some 3 months later that he had passed away. It's interesting that the school, Paracelsus College, we studied in a large meeting room at a long table that would probably hold 20 some odd people. Albert would lecture us without notes. He was wonderful, really. He had a very melodic voice and really pretty much took no nonsense from anyone. The harshest word that I ever heard him use, he referred to something as being baloney. And he looked to make sure that his wife was not, Emmy, her name, to make sure Emmy was not within earshot. In this meeting room, which was separate from the laboratories where we did practical work, there were thousands of volumes. And as first-year students, we were instructed that the library is not for you. Don't touch it. Well, yeah, that didn't happen. At night, we would go in there and rewrite our notes from the day and look through books. And I saw the 1930s or 1940 edition of Regardi's work. I think it was called The Golden Dawn. I forgot what the title was. And inside each of the three volumes was the name George Finsky. And I had known George at large, didn't know him as a friend at this point. And so the following morning, Albertus comes to the door of the teaching building. And I said, do you know George Finsky? And he lit up in a big smile and said, yes, I've known George for a long time. We're still in contact. continually. I've spoken to him this week. And so I used to stalk George and ask questions about alchemy, which he evaded for many months after that. But Albertus would give meditations every morning before lectures. And for example, he would say, God is good. God is good. God is good. He also used some parts that came from the Master Amatu. When God ordained that man should learn through woe, he too ordained the path that he should go, till through the mist that clothe the hills of pain, he shall emerge and find the sun again. One section of that large room was a vault. The vault was open, and of course, we went in. And in there, I saw all of the Amorth monographs, all of the TMO Martinist monographs, and who knows what else, but I recognized those. And those were Albert's. He was a life member of Amorth, as was Jean Dupuis, as was George Finsky.
You know, you said about Albert is never swearing, and I remember hearing a story where someone was talking privately in their room to another attendee, another student, and he said something, you know, this is bullshit. And they said the next.
He did say that.
And he said the next morning, they were shocked because he looked right at the fellow and said, "And this is not bullshit." And it was like a bomb had gone off.
Something amazing about that is that he said a word harsher than baloney. The story was related to me by a fellow named Chris, who was the first advanced student of Albertus that I met outside of the school. I don't remember how we got in touch, but he related the story that someone that he knew and perhaps that had the incident, something that Albert had said, struck him wrong, and he's going, "That's bullshit." And Albert looks at him and says, "It's not bullshit."
Well,
I think that would be life-changing, perhaps, that your thoughts are not private.
Well, that story, along with something Jack Glass had said, and maybe you could tell us a little bit of who Glass was, but also from Wyshewski that, you know, and that Albertus knew what was going on in that school. I mean, he did not have to be physically present, that he would just naturally demonstrate not only a kind of high level of intuitiveness, but also, and this is what really alchemy is when we get right down to it, when we get to the nut of it, it's really psychokinesis. And he could develop a high level, he showed a high level of psychokinetic ability, not just through what we would say, through the manipulation of the materials themselves. And I think Jack had said that he watched him pick up a crucible without gloves that should have scalded him. And it had no impact. He simply said, "It's not hot enough."
It was Wyshewski and who you knew quite well, and a fellow named Kurt Kobelars,
They were very close. Those two were very close, by the way.
Yes. Well, it was, to my understanding from Kurt, it was the two of them that did a lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram at TRS, at the college. And Albertus waked them over the coals about it the next day. Who are you to do such a thing here? He made it very clear to us two things. First thing that he said when we entered the classroom is, there are these shelves right up near the top of the wall. And that is where I ask you to leave all of your current beliefs, all of your present day thoughts about what is and what is not. Please put them there and leave them for the duration of the class. If you wish to take them back with you after the conclusion of the class, please do so. He also indicated that our conduct there needed, he spoke to the egregore, if you will, saying that our conduct needed to be correct in certain ways out of respect to those who came before, who were still connected, we might say.
That's fascinating, because, you know, the notion of proper conduct, proper speech, these aspects of proper respect, you know, actually putting enough ideas aside as you go in to learn something new, are extremely problematic today. I mean, we could get to that at some other point, but you were learning in a very old school fashion. There weren't handouts, there weren't overheads. You had to take notes. I saw some of the intricate notes from your own notebook on the diagrams. You were responsible for your learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And our own unlearning.
Yeah, well, yes, you're unlearning first, right? And this goes into something that I've talked about often, is people say, well, why do I need to do purification rituals or purifications or meditations or confessions? And the reason is because you need to unlearn. You know, if we want to go forward, we have to get at least temporarily put our ideas on a shelf.
I've found that almost humorously in my own life, when at some point in time, Hans Menzel, who had organized a group called RAMS, Restorers of Ancient, or Restorers of Alchemical Manuscripts Society, I made contact with Menzel in 82, 83, because folks at PRS recommended that I contact him, that he had some good translations of alchemical texts. And Hans and I began a relationship. And as I would read these things, I found that I had a block, that I thought that the alchemical work proceeded in a certain way, use certain materials. And so when I would see a manuscript that says, oh, no, let's work this way, let's use regulus of antimony and mercury, I would go, oh, that's not it. And so this has been something that I've encountered many times, is whatever my latest learning would become, that would become a filter that I applied to all new possibilities of learning. And I would reject certain things out of hand and yet find myself coming back to those later and then believing that that was the only way to work. Again, it's a tricky thing. How do we begin to acquire information, ideas, input from people who are advanced teachers, how do we take this information in without becoming blind to everything that doesn't fit that? It's an ongoing dilemma for me.
And I think you're not alone in it. We joked many times, many of us, about at that time what we referred to as Amorkians, you know, people who were members of the organization and were kind of this true believer status. And now we see the term fundamentalists, like occult fundamentalists or esoteric fundamentalists that we see propping up, where they have a notion of the way things are to be, and often they're new to the organization, or they don't have years of experience behind them, but it's because they've traded one belief for another. And of course, now they take everything they have learned or read, I should say, read as truth, and they don't have a lot of inner experience to back that up. And only when we take that outer idea and begin to ingest it and make it our own, do we begin to recognize the subtleties of the process, that things aren't always as straightforward as we'd like them to be. If they were, everyone who enters the path would be more quickly at the goal they want to be at. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of your most significant experiences that you had around Albertus or Jean Dubuis or Orfensky or some of these other wonderful folks that you've known, and how that shaped you.
We've not talked about Jean Dubuis previously, I think. I met Jean Dubuis in I believe 1992, and at a seminar in Canada. By this time, I had already become a member of a group called at that time LPN USA, which was came from the French name Les Philosophes de la Nature. The philosophers of nature. Dubuis had started this group in 1979, and he had experience as a physicist. He had a Jesuit education. He could argue with anyone, debate actually, and a very intelligent fellow with a wonderful wit and sense of humor. There are numerous anecdotes about Dubuis as a miracle worker. And I know some of those, but I think I will skip those. To say that when I stayed in Dubuis' home, it was difficult to sleep. And other people had noticed the same thing. And the best that we came up with is that during his sleep, he was working very hard. And it, you might say by inductance, sort of kept everybody else awake at night. Yeah, Dubuis was a wonderful fellow. Again, a lifetime AMLRC member, head of a Martinist lodge in Paris. One story that Dubuis related, his group was at the Heptad Abbey de la Noue, and It was a large group. I think there were close to 200 members. And there was an advanced class called the Second Circle, where members studied Kabbalah, which was primary interest and primary focus. When he worked for IBM France, he did a lot of practical alchemy study and alchemy, or Kabbalah practice and Kabbalah study, there in his office. He told us about when his Martinist group, he was asked to allow another Martinist group operating in Paris, also under the TMO, to join his group for a Yeheshua ceremony. And Dubuis initially refused it, saying this is not okay for a number of reasons. They pressed him on that, and he says it's because our group has more experience in working with elevated states of consciousness. And the pressure was something he eventually gave into. He indicated that during the ceremony, which he had to interrupt in progress because people from the other group were bleeding from their eyes and ears. So it was the ability to take a group of people and to create conditions through theurgy that affected them physically, psychically, emotionally. It was something that he very much brought to the conferences that he did in the U.S. and did in France as well.
Just let me state for the listeners, the Yeheshua ceremony is a Martinist ritual done around the winter solstice, and that it is essentially a ritual aimed at hope having someone open up to get a glimpse of or possibly experience what we would in Kabbalistic terms call the energies of Tiferet. And anyone familiar with the symbolism there can quickly understand why that high level of pressure, which is mentioned in other areas of psychic research, it's often ignored now by occultists, but in early psychic research, we do see references to this, that it's not just headaches, but it can be nosebleeds, again, bleeding from the nose, but also the eyes and the ears, if that pressure is, if one is not acclimated to it. I'm sorry, I just wanted to make that clear. Please go ahead.
And I'm sorry, we had a bit of a glitch on the audio, but I think we're okay now. So, yes, I had some very interesting experiences with Dupuis, whether it would be for him to be present in my dream life or not. My present wife, Susan, who you've not met, met Dupuis in our home when we moved to Tennessee, and it was not too long after he had left the planet. So she had an encounter with Sean post disincarnation, you might say. I have a tremendous fondness for George Svensky, Frater Albertus, or Jean Dubuis, also for Jack Glass, who we mentioned briefly before. Jack Glass from Youngstown, Ohio, or from Struthers, Ohio, passed away a few years ago. He and George Svensky co-instructed the Amwork Alchemy classes that began in 1989. And George had told me one day in 1988 that he and Jack were going to be teaching these classes. And so I arranged to be a student. And there were 40 students in attendance. People of all ages, people from Czechoslovakia, from Germany, from Portugal, from all over the U.S. One of them had been a Navy test pilot, knew Charles Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart. I had some wonderful people there. I got to know Jack Glass through those classes and discovered that he had taken all 7 years of Brad Alberta's instruction twice. So he had been a student there for 14 years. And these classes at that time were at Paracelsus College, were 2 weeks in duration. Also for the first years from 1989 until 1991, the AMWORK classes were also 2 weeks in duration. So we would have classes 8 hours a day. I think maybe we took off Saturday and Sunday, I can't recall. And then we get back to it the next week. So there was very much the model of what Albertus had done with 2 week classes, pretty much the same thing in the AMWORK classes.
You know, when you were taking over the running of Philosophers of Nature, you had already had a lot of experience with AMWORK, running a lodge, and many people don't seem to understand that when we take on those responsibilities, it puts a tremendous amount of strain on other areas of our life. And what is it you can look back at because of that? I mean, there was a tremendous amount of personal sacrifice. And I remember you telling me just jokingly that, you know, that at that one point you were so involved in running the Philosophers of Nature, you and your wife Sue at the time, and that you'd gotten a notice that I think your light bill was going to get turned off or something, because things like that happen. You know, you get so involved in what you're doing that often some of the day-to-day necessities of our daily life either get neglected or they get pushed to the side accidentally. But when you look back at that time, what would you say were the biggest benefits and obstacles that you and those, maybe others that you knew, that you spoke to, experienced, not just in the Philosophers of Nature, but maybe in other areas of your activities too?
And I'm going to wait a moment for, good. We're back in sync now. I think we had bad signal for a moment. If I understand, what you're asking is something about my experiences when I had concentrated efforts on working with Philosophers of Nature or with the AMWORK things or as Master of the Lodge, something of those.
Is that correct? Yeah, what were kind of the benefits and obstacles and kind of the lessons learned? What did you take away from all that when you look back on it? Because in the heady rush of it all, I mean, I remember being in your house and, you know, that whole room is just, you know, it's a copier and offices and stuff's going on and people are coming and going. You know, sometimes that ability to make sense of all of that action and activity isn't always there. What was the big takeaways that you got from it personally, as well as maybe in a broader sense to share from being that deeply involved in a movement and an activity that now is just really, many people see it as a part of history. They don't really understand what we went through.
The difficult times, I think, to begin there, after working with Philosophers of Nature, which I was working probably 50 for 60 hours a week. As an executive in a manufacturing company. And so I was perpetually tired, you might say. Also, there were continual things to do, whether it was to produce articles for a newsletter, to do some editing, to get things ready for a seminar. None of those things, none of the real life of the philosophers of nature in the United States would have happened without my wife, Sue Ellen. A lot of people were just amazed with the things that happened. Well, those were the things that she made happen. All of the logistics, dealing with caterers, finding places for the venues. I think my own contribution was more to sit back and have ideas. Issues when trying to build furnaces or something. So I had tremendous help. The organization had tremendous help and support. The organization group in France imploded, and Dupuis resigned from the organization he had created over some philosophical and ethical concerns, which also had a tremendous effect on me. After on 12/31/1999, which I have to admit, I jokingly did because it was the beginning of the new millennia. I found myself there was no energy for me to do anything, to try and have clear and logical thoughts about solving problems or doing things outside of the narrow things I was doing at work. It was impossible. And I spoke to my friends Patrice and Etienne, who found themselves in a very simple situation.
You broke up for a second there.
Since sort of a dark night. Sorry, repeat, please.
I'm just saying you broke up for a second there. So they found themselves in a similar situation.
Yes, they also experienced a bit of a dark night, and I think that collectively they went on for some 2 or 3 years after. The rewards, however, whether it was working in various capacities as a lodge officer for AMORC or working through instruction after George Finsky had passed. Jack Glass and I co-instructed the alchemy classes. The greatest benefit always came in the form of people. We met through this some of the most astounding, wonderful people who were very uplifting and a joy to be around. Some people who became lifelong friends, of course. Esoteric group orders and so on. Well, what are they if you have no people in them? The real value can come through the people. And also all of the conflicts that take this cubic stone that we begin with and turn it into a round ball by not
stuff. You're breaking up there.
I think it's those Sorry. Yeah, same here. I need to see something. One moment.
Okay. Well, I had that conversation with David Burnett, who was Grand Treasurer of the English Grand Lodge in the early 90s, and several other folks. And we said that we were in the organization, AMWORK, really at the best time, because even though there would be problems in the 90s that would affect all of us, we met a tremendous amount of really great people. We met just stunning people. And like you said, lifelong friends came of it, but not just friendship, but useful examples of principles or teachings in action, if you will.
And I apologize, Mark. I'm not certain that I understood the question exactly. I'm also dealing with some...
I was just commenting that we met some really wonderful people at that time, and that it really is the people that shape the experiences that we have in all areas of our life, but in these esoteric movements in particular, because we get to see the principles in action in many ways.
Yes. In fact... It's still amazing to me the power of genuine goodness that radiates through people who are working on this path. It's difficult to put that into words. The idea of egregore, which you have explored a great deal, there's the positive aspect, a hugely positive aspect of egregore. And there are days when I commute to work. Most days on the way there and on the way back, I'm thanking the immortal gods and my good and honest daemons. And often I find that I am going back and thanking important persons in my life, which began with my parents, who were wonderful in every way to me, and to siblings and to the people that I began to recognize as special teachers on the esoteric path. I probably have not yet thanked everybody, but one of the people that I will thank who comes outside of the strictly alchemical realm, and I think earlier we mentioned that I had done an experiment with some mushrooms. Well, probably about 8 years before that time, I had access to some very potent and very trustworthy psychedelics, and I studied those rather than the school subjects at the university where I was. I studied them rigorously, we might say, and I found after a year of doing that I needed some help to get things back to some sort of reasonable balance in life, because I could be in a different world quite readily and not be as capable as I needed to be in this world. And I found a psychiatrist, a fellow named John Perks, who practiced in Lexington, Kentucky, and also had a comprehensive care center in my hometown. And so I went there and met with him. One reason that I picked him is that he had experience with LSD, which I forgot, he told me years later which person it was who had worked with him that way. Something quite interesting, the things that he prescribed for me was to start the Canadian Air Force. There was a regime that you would do of running and walking and in an accelerated way. He says you need to get back to your body. And he said you also need some interesting thoughts to your mind. So he prescribed In Search of the Miraculous by Ouspensky. And he said you also need to look into meditation. And he introduced me to a meditation group that happened to meet in the church where I had gone since I was a child. And he treated me homeopathically as well. None of the then in vogue psychiatric drugs. But he gave me homeopathic LSD, for example. And in some period of months, perhaps a year, we associated. And we lost touch as time went on, but we reconnected perhaps 5 or 6 years ago. And so my wife and I were a guest in his home 2 or 3 times. John had grown up in California. He was one of the first disciples of one of the first holy men to come to the U.S. I can't remember the name at the moment. John graduated Harvard Medical School in 1950. He knew Richard Alpert. He was there during the Easter experiment that was done. John's specialty was in multiple personality work, which I think perhaps I didn't interest him too much in that regard. But he recognized that I was someone who could use some help. And he asked me, what is it that you want to be? And I said, a shaman. And he says, well, we've got work to do because a shaman needs to function well in two worlds. And you're not particularly clear in either one. So let's work. And we became tremendous friends. At some point in the 70s or 80s, I did reconnect with him briefly in the 80s. I was then, I think, in 8th or 9th degree of AMWORK, and I sent John a note and said, you know, John, I think you might find something of interest here. He wrote back to me and said, yes, I'm a member in the higher degrees, and among the various people that I gave hints to about this, you're the only one who pursued it. And I never recalled him ever giving me a hint, except that one time I went to a psychosynthesis workshop in his home, and Manly Hall's Secret Symbol Through the Ages was open to the picture of CRC. He and I never discussed AMWORK before that, but he was a member. He was an expert in Goethe and in Steiner. and was a biodynamic farmer. And at some point before I saw him in Kentucky, after he was quite elderly then and had two hip replacements. And you would look at him and wonder how he could walk, and yet he walked me all over his property, up hills, down hills, by the rivers. And so Russ, I have to say that...
Russ, there seems to be a little bit of static coming off your microphone. It seems to be rubbing on something.
Sorry, Mark. Good.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
Yes. So John Parks was, outside of people in my family who were there to give spiritual messages, John Parks was the first person I recognized outside my family. And he was a genuine Rose Qua. He was a healer and an adept and quite amazing fellow. I think he had been a Methodist or Episcopalian. After his wife had passed, and after the trouble we had back in 9/11, whatever year that was, John converted to Islam in Mecca, and he was a very avid spokesman in Lexington, and appeared with various councils of religions to, I think that frankly it was a path of service and sacrifice that he undertook to help prevent the radical dislike of Islam. By there was a lot of mistaken hatred, frankly, that really is, it happens only when there is a dogmatic views expressed. The hatred is not within Islam, I think was his message.
It's fascinating. And the people around us that have impacts on us, we often don't recognize it at the time, but years later we get to see that as time and space, if you will, which are the same thing, as they go, as they expand, we get a bigger picture of many of the experiences which we've had. And that possibly brings us to maybe our final question, at least the only one that I have really for you, is you know, what do you see now as the greatest challenges for students of esotericism in general, and maybe alchemy in particular, right now in this current day and age of 2020, and maybe going into the future?
Wonderful question. It's one that I've not thought about a great deal, so my answer will be a bit spontaneous. I think that the greatest blessing we have is the greatest curse. The greatest blessing, the information that I had to go to libraries, and libraries who had held a physical copy of a book I wanted, or using interlibrary loan to get a book that's held in another library. I mean, that's, who does that anymore? We have the internet. You can get everything. It's all there. That's the curse. There is, as you are likely well aware, the coursework of Jean Dupuis, Philosophers in Nature Lessons, they are readily available, as they should be. They are available legitimately. Through two sources. One is PON Press by Lenny Peterson, and that is for the book versions, and the other one is through a group called Inner Garden Foundation for electronic copies. Something that is different, much as in Amwork, that had been Jean Dupuis' background, the idea is that you get some monographs that are sent to you every 2 weeks or every month, and you study them, and you pore over those and add on what you've learned from preceding monographs. But there's a pace to it that you can't go beyond. When I had become a member of LPN and years before and had done so with some experience, I was receiving them essentially as they were being translated. But I would come to points where it's like, what do you mean I've got to wait 2 months to see the second part of this thing you just sent me the first two? You need to see both parts to make it a whole. So some years later, when I was president of Philosophers of Nature, I said, you know, you want to buy the esoterics course of 12 lessons? It's not going to take you 12 months to get it. You get it all at once. And part of that was based on my own way of learning. I might skip from the front of the book to the back of the book and then go back through the middle before reading the whole thing. Because sometimes I need to see conclusions and then go back to the starting points to let things flow. And I realized that other people likewise have unique ways of learning. So I said, okay, great. You can grab the whole course at once. Well, with the internet, we see the explosion of this. You can have hundreds of courses all at once, except that we cannot digest, we cannot process dozens of courses. It's difficult enough to follow one. So I think that it's nothing new to dilettante. Is not a new word. But we might say dilettante is one who dabbles in some number of things, a jack of all esoteric pursuits and a master of none. So I think that this is the wonderful thing about the internet is we can try and get a good sense of what variety of things are there to see what resonates with us most clearly. Hugely important to find this resonance. After finding the resonance, then I think it's time to drill in and to pursue or exhaust the work of a specific school or a specific author or a group of authors. And exhaust it until we decide that it's we need to move to something else. But to without the effort being made, the fact that there is so much attractive candy in the candy store is poses a difficulty. I will say that after my experience with Philosophers of Nature, with Amwork, and all of these other things that I look back to as being so important to my life, very informative of who I am, I really had no interest in being a member of any sort of group. I did become a member of a group headquartered in the Netherlands, the Inner Garden Foundation. And to my mind, they offer a very healthy, excellent approach to pursuit of alchemy in particular. I'm unaware of any other school that works quite that well. I've not, while I know Robert Bartlett, we've met and had very good feeling from him. I've not participated in his school, but I think that if I were starting, I would want to spend time with him. I would, so there's another option, I think, for folks to pursue.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, the difference now is that everyone has so much available to them. There's kind of a information bulimia that tends to take place. There's a binge and purge approach to everything, and nothing really gets digested or internalized. So there's a kind of, if we will say, not just a psychic indigestion, but actual kind of a psychic malnutrition that takes place. Because it's never made a part of oneself, which is the phrase that I learned from the philosophers of nature, from Dubuis, was this notion of an esoteric culture, that what we're doing is we're acculturating our own unconscious in a particular fashion and direction, and that takes time to shape, time to absorb, so that these ideas are a part of us, they are spontaneous and natural, and we're not having to actually think about it. Because it's like language. If we have to think about it, then we're not fluent in it. And that the notion of symbolic fluency or experiential fluency, a lot of those notions that he brought forth so clearly were very influential for me. Well, is there any parting words of wisdom? I mean, we seem to have covered all ground. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Looking at a couple of notes, and I think my excitement at finally discovering a book that led me to a living alchemist. And then I met Albertus, studied in his school, and 3 months after our meeting, he was lost to me. And I received a note from Hans Menzel announcing a 2-week seminar to be given in Texas by an Australian alchemist who had studied with Albertus, who was in fact one of the officers of Paracelsus College, Australia. And so I studied with Artophorus for 2 weeks. Artophorus has published in the meantime, and we've been in contact within the past couple of months, so he's still out there. I had, after meeting him, I decided to offer my home and laboratory to host a seminar the following year, to which he agreed. And not long before the time the seminar was supposed to happen, I got a note from Arthur's wife that he was unwell. In fact, he had been institutionalized and could not teach the course. And so I thought, oh no, I've lost another one. Then, after pursuing my friend George, my later to be friend, George Finsky, around the lodge and asking him questions about alchemy, to which he would only say, stick with the monographs, it's all in there. Eventually one day I said, did you ever distill lead acetate, George? He goes, did you? What did you get? What did it smell like? What color was this and that? and George came to my home. And I guess he saw that I was already far enough down the path that he wasn't corrupting a newbie. And so George and I developed a wonderful relationship. Then he too was lost. So my parting thought would be this. When a student is ready, the master will appear and reappear and reappear and reappear. Through whatever circumstances you are in, for as long as you need them, as long as you are willing to acknowledge them. If you truly seek, God is a great, generous being. There might be too much information. There might be bulimia, but hang on. It's all good.
Wow, that's really good, wonderful words of encouragement, particularly when folks feel so, again, overwhelmed. So much is available, but I don't know what to do. But again, it's that dedication and that perseverance that carries us through, and the way will be made clear to us. I felt that same discouragement. I had signed up for the alchemy classes at Amwork. You were going to be teaching them. They were canceled. Someone else was put in charge. It was an herbalism class they were doing. I somehow, from Gnosis Magazine, I got on a mailing list for LPN USA. I received a notice of a fellow out in a German fellow going to be teaching in San Francisco. I ignored the seminar. And then later I get a notice of the conference at Wild Rose Conference Center, Girl Scout Conference Center. And you and Jack were teaching, and I recognized your names, and that's why I went. And the rest, as they say, is history. So, yes.
Something else, Mark, if I might.
Sure.
I would like to tell you how much I appreciate how much you have done. You have helped create a very real sense of community, which is something that we very much need. I appreciate that you have you well apply a critical sense of thinking. You're not easily bamboozled, I think. And you've written some really tremendous books. Your history on alchemy in the USA, going back to Winthrop, for example, and drawing connections through Albertus and so on. I very much appreciate that you were able to take some historical research and to apply oral tradition. And I sense that that's what I'm participating in with you today, because there will be a day that you and I may not speak to each other. We may not speak to anyone except by the little traces that we leave. And let us hope that we leave some good traces, because we're very much indebted to the good traces that people left for us.
Yes, that is the message of turning our attention to the lineage. And the lineage is not just initiatic lines of people we've known through organizations, but the entire lineage of adepts and people and students who have sacrificed and have moved everything forward, and that we turn our attention to them with gratitude and thanks, and recognize that we are a link in that chain, and that hopefully that we can pass that on to others. Because that is the gift we give ourselves into the future until the work is done. We are constantly moving that chain forward so that at one point our own work will be complete, whatever that happens to be. Well, I thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule, for having this time and recording with us. As we said, it's both for time and eternity. And it's been a great 30 years almost of knowing you. It's been that long. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my friend and brother.